We're living longer than we used to, so either out of choice or necessity, we're working longer. The idea of three stages of life, learning, earning, and then retiring, is increasingly outdated. So many people, like Tom Andrew, are working full careers and then, relatively late in life, reinventing themselves. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, how to design life's third act. Tom Andrew is with us right now, and Tom, great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Anthony.
So, Tom, you worked for decades as a doctor, including 20 years as the chief medical examiner for the state of New Hampshire. But at the age of 61, and that was a few years ago, you'd had enough. What happened?
Well, indeed. And I don't know that it's so much of a reinvention as it is a kind of a sublimation of everything that came before it. But my goal at the beginning was to serve 20 years. The only question was what would come after that. But my experience with the opiate crisis sort of solidified the direction I would eventually take. And it was into ministry for reasons that we'll probably get into later.
Right, right. So stick with that opioid crisis. So in other words, you were working a job that not only required a high degree of professionalism, but there was a certain intensity at that moment around it, right?
No, absolutely. And it came upon us, obviously, in the early 2000s, as is well documented. But as the problem increased in intensity, and our drug deaths went from 50 to 100 to 250 to almost 500 a year over the course of that decade, that's what really got me thinking about being on the other end of the public health spectrum and looking at this problem from the prevention side rather than the assessment side.
So what that means is, yeah, it isn't fair to talk about what you did as retiring in the traditional sense because you didn't accept the gold watch and then move on to a life of leisure. You decided to go into the ministry. That meant going back, not back, that meant going to seminary. Tell us about that.
Indeed. And going back is probably correct because one of the things I had to provide was my college transcript. Imagine trying to get a transcript from 1978 to provide to these folks. But nevertheless, the good folks at the University of Dayton were able to do that. But I was jazzed about the possibility. So the prospect of 3 years of deep study was actually exciting rather than intimidating.
And we should say you're in the process even today of becoming a deacon for the Methodist Church.
Correct.
Right. Correct. So the process, so you've got your divinity degree, but there's more to do to sort of reach that goal of becoming a full-fledged deacon. Do I have that right?
That's right. And that is a denominational thing. Obviously, different Protestant denominations, if you will, have different pathways to ordination. And I happen to be in the maelstrom of the Methodist system.
Right, right. And your hope and your intention is to be a deacon and minister to the Boy Scouts.
That's correct. The end game, if you will, is being appointed as chaplain to the Daniel Webster Council of Scouting BSA in the state of New Hampshire.
So, Tom, why did you take this route? I mean, I spoke to you last week and you said you could have retired to a cabin in the North Woods, settled down with your books, and just disengage. You didn't choose that route. Why not?
Well, unfortunately, it's just not or fortunately, that's not the way I'm wired. I can't seem to disengage. After you've seen what I've seen for as long as I've seen it, there is, at least for me, a strong, strong push to try and do something about what you saw. Now, one person can't change the world. We all know that.
Right.
But one scout at a time, I can make a difference in young people's lives. And I've always enjoyed scouting. I've been plugged into scouting since I was a Cub Scout. And this was the vehicle that was calling to me in terms of ministry.
Well, Tom, stand by. There's a lot more to talk to you about this life change and about this decision. But I want to hear briefly from Barbara Waxman about this subject. Barbara is a gerontologist and life coach who has spent a lot of years thinking, writing, and talking about this phase of life. And here's one of the key points she makes.
A little over a century ago, life expectancy in the U.S. was about 47 years old. Well, today, life expectancy hovers around 80. So that's the real clincher that's changed. We've added 30 years to our life expectancy.
Okay, so far so good, but here's the problem as Waxman sees it. A lot of people think that this expanded life expectancy, those extra 3 decades, mean they're going to be older longer.
And that is not how we experience those years. We experience an expanded midsection. It's actually a gift if we can shift our cultural narrative about this expanded midlife.
Waxman and others who study this call this period of life middlescence. Like adolescence, middlescence is a time of change, of tumult, but also opportunity and growth. Waxman says it's a time when people have the chance to give up what she calls that sticky commitment to conformity.
It's a time in life where hormones change, relationships also change, whether it's divorce, empty nest, major career shift. There are more transitions during midlife than any other time in life, and yet we have this idea it's stagnant. What if we enabled people to understand, oh, when I get to that time in life, I'm going to have a reboot. Here's the opportunity. When you're in midlife, it's the coolest place to be because you get to reassess.
Again, that was Barbara Waxman, gerontologist, life coach. She's been writing and talking a lot about this phase of life when people are rethinking what they're doing. And back to you, Tom Andrew, in the studio. What do you hear in Barbara Waxman's take on this and how it might apply to your situation?
Well, I think it's, well, on point, if you will. The idea of pulling back and being stagnant or disengaged is exceedingly unappealing in a time when, even in one's 60s, given the availability of the incredible health care that we have, I'm a healthy guy who has a lot of energy. And it seems to me that that energy is wasted if you have withdrawn into your safe cocoon. Mm. I still want to share what I have, and I'd like to share it with young people. Obviously, youth is wasted on the young. So I want to try and impart to them what I have learned, and we think they're not listening. Mm. We get the impression sometimes that they're dismissive. But if time over the decades in scouting has told me anything, the feedback that I get from some of these kids 10, 15, 20 years later tells me they were listening.
So is there this link? We talked about your work as a forensic pathologist and how you really lived and saw the worst moments of this opioid addiction crisis when you were working, doing that job in New Hampshire. Is this really a feeling that, you know, to get back to early on in people's lives, you might be able to help them avoid such a fate?
That's exactly where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
As we talked about last week, public health has a big arc, and that arc begins with prevention and it ends with assessment. I spent 20 years on the assessment end, counting the cost, cleaning up the mess. And when I wanted to make my change, I wanted to flop back to the beginning of that spectrum and work with young people, particularly in the atmosphere of the great outdoors, which is what scouting is all about, and let them see that there's a better way than that pill or that powder or that joint that's offered to them by their erstwhile friend.
Yeah. You know, what's so intriguing about your story, and actually about a lot of the stories that we're going to be hearing about this hour, is you're taking a big risk because, you know, we mentioned that you've worked for decades as a doctor. You really reached the sort of pinnacle of expertise in this field. And to give that up and to take this leap, well, I don't know, it sounds to me like an act of courage. I mean, how did you process that? How did you give yourself the strength, I guess, to sort of say, yeah, I'm going to leave that behind and at the age of 61, go into ministry and deal with the bureaucracy of a church and do what it takes to do this next step?
Well, to be honest with you, I cheated a little bit. And I've taken a middle road. Even after I left state service, I've stayed active as a consultant in forensic medicine, and I have a consultancy service. So I'm shedding my previous life in fits and starts and bits and pieces. But at a targeted time, that is going to be left behind for good, and the focus will be on ministry. So I'm doing it in a titrated manner.
I see.
It's not a cold turkey thing.
Right. But it still feels like a leap. And I guess in your case, it's fair to call it a leap of faith.
Indeed. But the leap does not appear to me or is not felt by me as one across a great chasm. Yeah. It's just that little step to take that completes what has been going on in my mind for many, many decades.
You know, I should say, and I meant to say this right at the top because it's really important to give attribution where attribution is due. I came across your story in the New York Times several years ago. Kathleen Seeley wrote a terrific story about the change you were making. She set out to talk about the opioid crisis and tracked you down in New Hampshire and then did this profile of a piece about this change that you're making. And I'd been thinking about this story among lots of people going through this, but I just wanted to give credit to Kit Seeley, who's just a terrific reporter and sort of did this story about you to begin with that kind of got us rolling here. I'm wondering what kind of reaction in the sort of 30 seconds we have before we move to break, what kind of reaction have you had since that story aired, since that story went to print?
Well, it was interesting. For the first, several weeks after it did hit print, particularly the online edition, it was the most read story on the New York Times website. It seemed to resonate with people. And I got messages from all over the country, people that either never experienced anything like that before and whose eyes were open to the possibility, to people who were given the courage, the encouragement to take that step.
To take that step. We're talking about shaking it up late in life, that opportunity that comes with living longer. My guest is Tom Andrew. He's the former chief medical examiner in New Hampshire, now on track to become a Methodist deacon. Stay with us. There's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking this hour about shaking things up late in life, specifically career shifts and reinventing yourself. Do you have a story to share about your own third act? If so, we'd love to hear it. You can share your third act story with us via the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. We're going to hear a little bit of tape now from some of what we've heard from our listeners. Jeanette called us from Portland, Maine to tell us her story. To her, getting older is also getting younger.
I was a technical writer for 30 years, and I had a great career, and I lived and worked in several different countries. Came back to the States and had a really good job. During COVID, I quit that job and decided I didn't want to put my heart and soul into another company again. You know, the mortgage is paid off. I don't need to make a lot of money, so I want to now do what I really want to do. So in a way, I'm kind of regressing in my head, but I know that I have less responsibilities financially. I can explore and do something different. So I think it's definitely I've turned a corner in my life now, and I'm into the next phase of it.
And here's Aaron. He called from Erie, Pennsylvania. He says he made the switch to a new career and says he's never been happier.
I'm going to be 50 in about a year and a half. And for about 20, 25 years, I did sales, sold advertising. I sold cars. I sold cable television subscriptions and mobile phones. And about a year and a half ago, I switched to being a driver, and I deliver medical goods from a pharmacy to sick people. And I am happier than I've ever been in my entire life. No more having to worry about making the sale, getting the person to buy this product or that product. Nope. I get a set amount of money each hour. I know what I'm going to make. And I get to drive all day and listen to podcasts and shows and music. And it's spectacular. And I love it.
Well, that's fantastic, Aaron. I hope you're listening to On Point right now. My guest is Tom Andrew. He's the former chief medical examiner in New Hampshire. He retired from that job at age 61, went to seminary, and is now on the road to become a Methodist deacon so that he can minister to the Boy Scouts. And joining us now is Chip Conley. For 24 years, he managed a boutique hotel company, then became head of global hospitality and strategy at Airbnb. And in 2018, he founded the Modern Elder Academy, the world's first midlife wisdom school in Baja California in Mexico, which we're going to talk about as well. But first, Chip Conley, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Anthony, it's great to be with you.
It's really good. I know you've been listening here. What are you hearing? Before we talk about your story, what are you hearing in Tom Andrew's story?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I hear someone who is growing not just old, but growing whole. There's an element of a desire to integrate all the parts of him and give back. Developmental psychologist Eric Erickson said, the most important question to ask after age 50 is, what will survive me? He said, I am what survives me. And I can hear Tom, you know, providing his legacy to these kids. Mm. I also loved hearing Barb Waxman. Barbara Waxman is one of our faculty members at MEA. So it was great to hear that little clip from her.
Right, right. So tell us a bit about your own journey, Chip, and coming to terms with your middle essence, I guess. You ran a successful boutique hotel company for 24 years, but you reached a point when you'd had enough. What happened?
You know, there's a social science research on the U-curve of happiness that shows that, generally speaking, again, your mileage may vary, Anthony, between 45 and 50, we hit our low point in adult satisfaction, life satisfaction. There's a lot of reasons for that. And I didn't know that U-curve of happiness research existed. And I hit 45 to 50, and I just had a really difficult time. I called it the midlife crisis. I now call it the midlife chrysalis, because actually for the butterfly, midlife is the chrysalis. It's where it's dark and gooey and solitary, but it's also where the transformation happened. And so I had a flatline experience. I actually died multiple times over the course of 90 minutes after giving a speech. And I woke up. I had the hotelier's wake-up call that I don't want to do this anymore. So at the bottom of the Great Recession, I decided to sell my boutique hotel company called Joie de Vivre, and wasn't sure what was next for me at age 50. And it was around that time that my life just took off in ways that I hadn't imagined. The societal narrative on aging is that if you can survive your midlife crisis, all you have to look forward to is disease, decrepitude, and death. But in fact, the U-curve of happiness research shows that after age 50, people get happier with each decade. And my 50s were my happiest decade of my life. I'm now 62 and really appreciating that I have something to offer. And my experience with the young founders of Airbnb helping to guide their company was one example of realizing that I still had some relevance in the world.
Well, I want to come back and ask you about that, but I want to just get Tom to respond to what he just heard. This sort of U-curve of happiness. I'm just wondering how you relate to that idea about sort of where you were in your 50s versus your 60s.
I'm sitting here with my mouth agape as I listen to Chip. It is no accident, Anthony, I think, that given this research, which is new to me today, that my struggle with the opiate crisis was from my 50th through my 60th year, if you do the math. And perhaps that dynamic pushing me toward what I eventually ended up doing or am doing now has some basis in science, which I had not realized. And I love the concept of chrysalis versus crisis.
By the way, I want to say about Chip, you've got a terrific TED Talk where you really lay out these concepts and get into that crisis versus chrysalis idea, among other things that I really recommend. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Chip, so you move on to Airbnb, and you're in this interesting role because you're kind of the older guy in a company full of sort of tech-savvy youngsters, right?
Yeah. It was a little over 10 years ago, so no one had ever heard of Airbnb. It was a tiny little tech startup that was growing, and I was someone with a deep hospitality and travel background, and I was an entrepreneur and CEO, so they reached out to me, the founders did, and said, hey, we would love to have you join the company because no one in our company understands the hospitality and travel business. And that's the industry we're disrupting. And so I joined, but the first day I was just shocked, like, oh my gosh, I'm 52 years old and the average age here is 26. And I'm in a tech company. And so I originally thought I'd be joining to sort of dispense wisdom, but I realized very quickly that I was going to learn as much as I was going to teach. And so within a few weeks, they started calling me Airbnb's modern elder. And I wasn't so fond of that, to be honest with you. It sounds like AARP's magazine. I was like, wait a minute, you know, you're ageist. No, they said, Chip, a modern elder is someone who's as curious as they are wise. And when I heard that, I said, okay, I will own that. And I ended up spending 7.5 years, 4 years full-time, 3.5 years as a very active strategic advisor part-time. And I came to realize that many companies could use a modern elder, someone who has the life experience and wisdom and maybe the emotional moderation, which is something we get better at as we get older, as our EQ grows and our ability to moderate our emotions improves. And a lot of younger companies with brilliant technologists could use someone like me. And that's when I decided to write a book called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. And as I was writing that book, the idea of the world's first midlife wisdom school came about, and the Modern Elder Academy.
The Modern Elder Academy, and I promise we're going to get to that, but I'm just struck by something that both you and Tom have talked about. I mean, Tom talking about working with the Boy Scouts and really bringing his wisdom to a much younger generation. You're really talking as well about your experience at Airbnb as this sort of cross-pollination and talking across and between the generations. And that seems like such an important theme in this phase of life, to be able to bring your wisdom to the next generation, but also for you to be able to benefit from hearing from the next generation. Does that make sense, Chip?
Oh, for sure. Couple thoughts there. Number one is, in the past, the way we looked at wisdom or knowledge transfer was from the old to the young. And today it's really reciprocal. I called myself a mentor at Airbnb, a mentor and an intern at the same time, because there were a number of younger employees who I was learning from. And yes, I was teaching as well. And so I think mutual mentorship is a big thing of the future across generations, since we have 5 generations in the workforce for the first time. Another term that I like to describe is like same seed, different soil. So Tom has a seed that he has developed over the course of his life. That seed is certainly public health and understanding medicine and understanding people. And now he's going to take that seed that he has developed, that gift, that skill he's built, and he can apply it in a different place. So same seed, different soil. He needs to take that seed and put it in new soil for it to actually fertilize and grow again. And that was the same for me, because I'd built a lot of skills and aptitudes and maybe some wisdom that I actually didn't really value, because they were sort of normal for me. And then I all of a sudden went from bricks and mortar to a tech company and realized that these kinds of skills, especially wisdom is very transferable across industries, knowledge isn't always transferable, but wisdom is.
That's interesting. So, Tom, same seed, different soil. Do you like that idea?
Oh, gotta love that idea. You know, in the faith tradition that I come from, there is a very famous story about seeds and soil, but a little off target for today, but I've used that word, legacy. I think Chip brought it up earlier, and that L word has always been floating around in my head. Once I hit that point where I knew I wanted to make that change, where I knew I wanted to put my seed in different soil, and I would often say to people, I am now in legacy mode, and I am building what I'm going to leave behind. Our experiences are so similar. It's amazing to me, and I would agree with Chip that it is reciprocal. I especially experienced this in seminary, that even though I was the old guy in the room, I learned as much from those young people as I hope I imparted on them.
Mm. Well, I love this. I love this connection that's happening between the two of you, and I'm sure among lots of people listening. Chip, I've got to ask you about the modern Elder Academy. It's described as the world's first midlife wisdom school. You've founded it there in Baja, California. Tell us about the MEA. What is it?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I was noticing, and this is also, I can't wait to meet Tom in person one of these days. I lost 5 friends to suicide. All of them midlife during the Great Recession. And so I had my own dark period, dark night of the soul, which led me to selling my company at the bottom of the recession. I had friends who took their own lives. And as I moved into my 50s and had a really wonderful decade, I started to ask myself, how can I give back? How can I try to help make sense of midlife? You know, midlife has a terrible brand. It's all about crisis. It's like the Rodney Dangerfield of life stages. It gets no respect. And so I really started to do a deep dive into the research on midlife and trying to understand it in a deeper way, and met and spent time with academics all over the world on this. And that led me to creating the school, partly because I really wanted to help give people a roadmap for reimagining and repurposing themselves amidst all the transitions that happen during midlife, not just in career, but, you know, it could be a divorce, it could be parents passing away, empty nest, a health diagnosis, etc. And so we opened a little over 5 years ago. We have over 3,000 alumni from 42 countries. We have 26 regional chapters around the world. We are based about 1 hour north of Cabo San Lucas on the Pacific Ocean. But we also have online programs, as well as I am right now in Santa Fe, New Mexico, because we will be opening 2 very large campuses, much larger than what we have in Baja, here, one opening in January next year and the other one opening a year later. So it's really a bit of a movement, the idea of how do we help people in the middle of their life reimagine their future, because the average age of the people who come to our program is 54, but we've had people of, you know, from 28 to 88. But if you're 54 and you're going to live till 90, you have 36 years of adulthood ahead of you, and you have 36 years of adulthood behind you if you start counting at age 18. Most people at age 54 don't think of themselves as halfway through adulthood.
Right. So a lot more life to lead there than we normally think about. So describe the profile of the typical person who comes to the MEA, though. Who are they? I'm sure it must be a range of folks.
It really is, because we have financial aid. So it's a very diverse collection of people, from nurses and elementary school teachers and firefighters to CEOs and investment bankers and physicians. Often it's people who are navigating a midlife transition of some kind. They feel a little bit stuck. They may feel like they don't have the resources to understand how to get through that transition. In some cases, we also have people who are coming because they want to really understand what does it mean to cultivate and harvest your wisdom. Wisdom is we are a very knowledge-based culture. And yet all of the knowledge is on your iPhone, in your pocket. And in the era of AI, artificial intelligence, knowledge is more and more of a commodity. And what is really valuable is wisdom. And we define wisdom as metabolized experience that leads to distilled compassion, because there is a social good in wisdom. And so we really help people to learn how to actually find their wisdom, unlock it, and then look at how you can make a difference in the world with that wisdom.
Well, Chip Conley, he's the former head of global hospitality and strategy at Airbnb, and he's founder of the Modern Elder Academy, the world's first midlife wisdom school in Baja California. And Chip, thanks so much for being with us. You've given us a lot to think about. We're really grateful.
Thank you. It's been great. And Tom, I look forward to meeting you.
You as well, Chip. I've got to get out to Baja.
Yeah, sounds like there's a good. There should be space out there for Tom, I think.
it's a good time. It's a good, nice time for weather there right now. So, if you're coming from the Northeast,
from snowy New Hampshire, I'm sure that would be appreciated. Tom Andrew, former chief medical examiner from the state of New Hampshire, stay with us. We're going to be back after a short break, and we're going to hear from Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, who literally wrote the book on this subject called The Third Chapter: Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50. Stay with us. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. On our show next week, we're going to be exploring the seemingly Byzantine world of occupational licensing. One in four workers are required to have a state license to do their job. And in most states, a license, say in cosmetology or construction, doesn't carry with you if you move to another state. So, do you need a state license to do your job? And what's been your experience if you do? Tell us your story by recording a message in the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. Or you can leave us a voicemail at this number, 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. This hour, we're talking about shaking things up late in life, specifically career shifts and reinventing yourself. Do you have a story to share about your own third act? If so, we want to hear it. We have an email that you can send your story to, because we're going to continue this project going forward. It's thirdactstory@gmail.com. That's all one word, written out, no numbers, thirdactstory@gmail.com. Send your story there. My guest is Tom Andrew, the former chief medical examiner in New Hampshire. He retired from the job at the age of 61, then went to seminary and is now on the road to become a Methodist deacon so that he can minister to the Boy Scouts. And joining us now is Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She's the Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard University, and she literally wrote the book on this subject in 2009. She published the third chapter, Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50. And Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's really good to have you. I want to ask you about this book. You spent a couple of years traveling the country interviewing some 40 different people who found a way to reinvent themselves during this period of life. Tell us the origin of this book. Why did you want to write it?
Well, I was about 60 at the time, and I found that everywhere I went, whether it was a professional meeting, a cocktail party, dinners with other friends, that someone would lean into me and say, in what I began to call confessional moments, say something about what they were doing, which excited them very much. about which they felt passionate. But they would talk about it with a kind of shyness and a kind of reticence, which seemed to say, I shouldn't be doing this. This is not my place. I'm conflicted about it. But on the other hand, what came through was something new in their lives, which had captured their imaginations and their attention, and they wanted to talk about it. And this kept on happening. And I wondered, you know, what were these confessional moments about? How were they motivated? And how hard was it for people to find their way from this life that they had been living to a life of change and reinvention and transformation? And so that was one of the reasons why I was very eager to begin this research project.
Right. And after doing this, what is important to understand about this period of life that many people may not understand?
Well, I think your guests, Tom Andrews and Chip Conway, were a wonderful, wonderful storytellers about this question. That is that I believe that this time between 50 and 75 may be the most generative and transformational time in our lives. And I say that because of this possibility that we heard from Chip Conway of really developing, experiencing the depth of wisdom that begins to be generative in the way we give to the world. One of the things I discovered in talking to folks was that most people who were changing from one thing to the other were changing in a direction of wanting to give forward to society, to make a difference on this planet and in this world. I use the word give forward because giving back feels a little bit nostalgic and anachronistic. And giving forward requires that we find a way to give our altruism to a world that's changing, that's rapidly transforming, which is another reason why we need to be deeply in intergenerational relationships with younger people and become learners of the world that they now inhabit. So giving forward means that we need to have these conversations, these relationships, to figure out how we might best be useful.
Well, I like that. And Chip Conley talked about that working at Airbnb with younger workers. Tom Andrew, who's still here in the studio, and let me sort of turn that idea of giving forward to you. This sounds very much like what you're thinking about in transitioning from being a professional physician to a deacon working with young Boy Scouts.
I agree. And what that does, and it hasn't been spoken yet, but it came to me that that's what puts us, meaning that older group, on equal footing with our Gen Zs, because one of their overarching drives is to make a difference, to do something that's important. It's not just a matter of making a lot of money and being comfortable. They want to make a difference. And if we share that, that really ought to lead to a synergy that can go in very good places. And, you know, just to circle back to knowledge and wisdom, oh my goodness. If you put a young person into the crucible of a great outdoors in scouting, they're going to know or learn pretty quickly the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And we can work together to work those issues out.
Mm. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, one of the themes in your book that I think is so important is that this transition, taking advantage of this wonderfully potentially transformative time in our lives, it requires willingness to take risks. It requires being open to being vulnerable and uncertainty. I learned all this from reading your book. How do we get over that?
You know, that's so interesting because I think one of the things which we have to talk about is how difficult this is for many people, that this is really very, very challenging. To take these risks, to leave whatever position you have of status and station and familiarity out, to leave that, to pursue this thing which is uncertain, which is unclear. And I talk about the first thing that we must always have if we're going to do this is a curiosity about the world around us. Really, we are deeply curious. We ask questions. We want to know. And then it seems to me as we that we have to lose some of our fear in taking this great risk. We have to lose our fear of failure, because inevitably in the short run we might fail, and we have to lose our fear of seeming foolish to others. I mean, there's something that may be infantilizing about beginning at the beginning when you don't know the way, and trying to find a way through this feeling of chaos and uncertainty. So losing our fear, accepting the vulnerability of this moment, being open to this, exposed to this, realizing that part of this process of growing and taking risks is being willing to be vulnerable. Mm. And I think the other thing that's important as we talk about this challenging transition is to recognize that just because we move to this next place, whatever it is, this moment of reinvention, doesn't mean that we lose the experiences of our former life. This is a very integrative, synergetic moment, it seems to me, where you become, I think, as Chip Conway said in his segment, more whole, wiser, but not just different, but more whole and layered and deep in your new identity.
Interesting. Tom, I'd love to sort of throw some of those ideas at you. I mean, Sarah there was talking about taking risks, you know, being willing to experience vulnerability, uncertainty. Is that something that you had to contend with to make this transition?
Only on a very concrete level.
Yeah.
And that was financial. Can I afford to take this crazy step, seemingly crazy step, forward? We still had one of our three in college, and I had to think long and hard from the financial end. But you know, Anthony, every other aspect was secondary to me. You know, the friends who would say, oh, that's very interesting. You know, why would you do something like that? You know, I was ready to field those questions. I was worried about the money.
Right. And how's that worked out?
It was never a problem. Our financial guy told me from the get-go, you're going to be fine. It was just a matter of believing him and moving forward, which I did, and it has.
Sarah, I want to ask you about this, the point that Chip raises, and that is about the money. All 40 of the people that you spoke to were people of a certain educational level. They all seem to be fairly well off. But are there lessons here for folks who might not be as well off? Because when we talk about living longer and working longer, a lot of people are working longer because they must. But they still may be in that moment of life where they're thinking about this sort of tumultuous set of forces where that is driving them to do something else.
Yes. Well, I learned about this a little bit more after I wrote the book, and I went on the road or to various NPR stations, and various people from all kinds of backgrounds called in to say that they felt very identified with much of what I had to say. And one of the things that I began to feel is I began to call a notion of perceived abundance. However much money you have, or however many resources you have, do you have enough in your life to begin to reimagine how it might be different? Is there enough space, emotional, spiritual, intellectual, cognitive space to reimagine what that might be? And, you know, getting a call from someone who's working at the Holiday Inn, who's cleaning rooms, who says to me, I'm 65 years old, I'm cleaning rooms, I love dogs, I've never had a dog because my work life has never permitted me to really have a dog and be close to a dog. And what had she decided to do? She had decided to work for a dog animal shelter, taking care of animals and then getting them to be adopted. In other words, she found a way in the context of her life to do something about which she felt passionate about, something she had wanted all of her life, and to weave that into it, even though she was not someone who had a lot of resources. And I kept on hearing those stories over and over again. So I think there are things to be learned, whether folks are highly educated, whether they have high incomes, whether their financial advisor says you're going to be fine or not, they find a way of taking this risk and pursuing another way of giving to the world.
Well, a couple of more voices from folks who are listening to us. Ellie called from Rockville, Maryland. She's 52 years old. She has an MBA and worked in government in the private sector. But she quit all that and started working in local public schools. And she encourages others to make that kind of change as well.
I get to use all the skills that I learned over the course of my life, so many of them in this job. I have to say I'm happier from a career standpoint than I've ever been in my life. So definitely go for it. Go back to school and change careers, even if it takes a little time or money. It's totally worth it.
And Wayne called in from Santa Barbara, California. He had quite a career, first as a physicist studying moon rocks, then running a nuclear research lab, and then as a truck driver delivering organic baby diapers. Today, he has his own business doing expert witness work in court. But he says it did not come easily.
Before that, I'd sent out 4,000 job applications with resume written by a professional. I never even got an interview. So my feeling is if you're over about 50, don't even think about applying for a job because you'll never get one. What you should do is open your own business. And that's what I did.
Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, I want to ask you about this. Are we set up for this group of people to be as productive and inventive as they're capable of being? And by that, I mean, are places of employment, work, workspaces, companies thinking about this group of people as a resource to be tapped and taken advantage of in all the right ways?
I think that there is... That we are not set up for that as a culture. One of the things that Barbara Waxman said earlier is that we need to shift our cultural narrative about this. We also have to change our institutional sort of routines and patterns to allow for this and to allow for the voice and the vision and the work, the wise work of elders. And I think that one of the things I think is important as an educator is that I learned from all of my interviewees, all of the folks said that the kind of learning that they were involved in and engaged in school, even when they were incredibly successful, being the first to raise your hand, speed, knowledge acquisition, achievement, purposefulness, blind sort of purposefulness, and competition are just the wrong elements and dimensions for the kind of learning and thinking that are required to take on this third chapter with imagination and with wisdom. That needs to be collaborative. It needs to be patient. It needs to not be cautious. It needs to allow for failure. We're not hiding our failure. We're learning, in fact, from the ways in which we fail, how we learn best. So there are ways in which the curriculum, the pedagogy, the teaching and learning that goes on in schools doesn't anticipate the longer arc of life and the kinds of ways in which people learn in what my children used to call the wide, wide world.
Right.
So that's another thing that we need to think about.
Well, lots to think about. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is the Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard University. She's the author of many books, including the third chapter, Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50. Professor Lawrence Lightfoot, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure to have you. And Tom Andrew, thank you for your story. Thank you for being here today. We really appreciate it.
It's been a delight. I've learned a lot today, Anthony.
And listeners, we're continuing this project, so send us your story about late life transitions at thirdactstory@gmail.com. That's all one word, thirdactstory@gmail.com. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.